really depend on momentum. So for all of us who are sponsoring folks, I really try to tell the people I sponsor, don't lose the momentum. That's part of the spiritual wheel. That's part of the thing that really helps illumination and really, really helps shed a light on the uncover part, the discover, and also helps with the discarding. It's the momentum of being in the steps. So writing all the stuff about my grudge list, which was very, very long, they then asked me to look at fear. But before we go there, they let me know that this inventory is the key to my future. And here's the point that I think so many people miss. I think it's the truest exercise once we get sober. And it's on 66, and it says, we were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And in my book, it's a question mark. So, can I look at my resentments? Can I look at my fears? And can I look at my sexual comportment from an entirely different angle? What angle? The angle of God, trusting and relying in God. And so this already starts to soften, and this already starts to change my point of view. And I love this other line. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. They were my gods. And that in this state of wrongdoing of others. And I love that fancy at our reel, already planting the seed. Sid, we might start looking at some stuff. It may not be what for years and decades you said it is, right? And had the power to actually kill. So remember, we're going to now look at, we're looking at resentment and how it can kill. And now we're going to look at fear and how it can kill. And yes, my sexual comportment and how it can kill. So that might sound harsh and a little over the top, but think of it as a consideration. My relationship with fear and my relationship with sex, when our book talks about spiritually sick, all they mean is separated from God. And I remember when going through the work with Bob O, he shared with me, you know, Sid, I don't know why people don't bring God into the bedroom, but that's really where God needs to be. And I thought, wow. So let's do first things first. These resentments are to be transcended, these fears are to be transcended. And the unwomaned, unmanned, centered heart space, you know, of my sexual conduct, of our sexual conduct, can be transcended as well. Doesn't mean you can't wear a pig mask and a tutu. I'm all about one love. I'm not going to even, there's nothing about sex that I find problematic or punishable. That's not who I am. Love who you love, get down the way you get down. But what's the quality of the heart? And do we know that God can actually be present and be experienced through union with someone else rather than it just being an act of taking and soothing desire and drives? All right. So that's the caveat. Here we go. Let's talk about fear. And I'm just going to talk on page 67. Some of the best, our fears actually come out of our four column inventory. I love that you write out the resentment, and alongside the resentment, you write two or three fears. Those are the fears that I look at. I don't have to keep generating them. I really am culling the fears from my inventory. The other thing that is happening is that the work that I did through Fellowship of the Spirit, going through the big book word by word, line by line, turning statements into questions, is you write down those fears that aren't attached to resentment. Oh, those can be so telling. So, fears of snakes, fears of bodily excrement, fear of deep water, fear of spiders. It's so cool to give the mind, after we write this heavy inventory all on resentment, see those fears that actually aren't attached to anything. It's a great way to see how the mind works and what it gets stuck on and how it needs something. It needs something in order to keep, quote unquote, feeling itself. And I was told as I was going through the work that it was all self-obsession. It was all selfishness. And I like this term that my sponsor used. It was all self-cherishing. You know, holding on to fear was a way through my early childhood, my drinking. I drank beyond my mental control, and the fears normally loom forward when I drink past what my mind can actually really deal with. Or if my behavior is so erroneous, so crazy, and so out there, then these fears come up and my mind coils around them so I can feel this sense of self. Again, it's not God. It's not wholesome. It's not other-centered. It's still me. So that's also something to look at. So let's dive in real quick. Notice that the word fear, I'm on the bottom of 67, is bracketed along the difficulties with Mr. Brown, that's earlier, and Mrs. Jones, the employer and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives, question mark. So cool to meditate on how much fear dominates me, how much fear I'm really feeling. So let me hold my hand up. Have I got any ragers out there? Have I got any physical violent people out there? Have I got people who are ranters, who scream, who holler, who berate? Oh, is this the graduate group? There's no one here? Cool. I'll speak for myself. What I've learned is that anger and rage actually go hand in hand with fear. What do I mean? Anger, for those of us who may not be able to express fear or who couldn't express fear or who fear got crushed so easy on it, made us too vulnerable. Okay, we got rid of fear. But what I saw with all the anger was that anger was a secondary emotion. There was actually something under here that I really, really cared about, but I had to learn how to get to that. And if I cared about something deeply, the fear was actually trying to protect it. Or sorry, the anger was actually trying to protect it, and the fear was masked. So when people say, I'm not afraid, I'm just angry, I've had to look at anger and also unpack it for fear. So I can see the ways that anger, fear had touched every aspect of my life. I love this. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of my existence was shot through with it. It's so interesting to look at. If I'm trying to accomplish something, going to school, you know, going out on a date, going on a job, showing up someplace out of fear versus out of the love of doing something, out of service, out of compassion. It's so cool to feel into that. It set in motion trains of circumstances what brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. Remember early on in the book, he says that people sense the unseen and the unsaid. And so people always knew I was afraid. They were talking about me being intense. They were talking about me being intimidating. This is fear showing up. It set the ball rolling. Sometimes, check this out, we think that fear ought to be classed with stealing. I want to talk it before it causes most trouble. I really want to unpack that and then we'll move on to sex. What does he mean by that? Man, Bill said so many cool things. And you know, I always tell people I'm a bigot and I'm a racist. I only do the black parts in the big book. I don't do anything else. I don't try to interpret. I don't try to find the loopholes. I just try to do what the first 100 men and women did and what Bill said he did. Is this me? Do I feel like this? Have I drank like this? Did I think like this? And this thing, what did he mean when fear ought to be classed with stealing? It robs you of everything. Let's just say that. But more than that, I beg you to know and really sense in yourself, everyone knows that stealing is wrong. You don't have to explain it. You don't have to define it. Everybody knows when something isn't theirs, even small kids, right? And so what that means is we already know that fear is separating us. We already must know that fear is actually that corrosive thread. It is the disconnector. It is the wall. It is what is blocking the sunlight of the spirit. And the beauty of it is, think about this. After we've had a deep and expected, a deep an effective experience. We've gone through the work, we've written some stuff about ourselves, we're becoming more useful in this program. To keep being driven by fear has to somehow be a choice or a habit of the mind that I need to exert vigilance on to break, which is prayer, meditation, 10-stepping service. So I just want to read this one little thing. Fear is the gradient ingredients that separates me from God and you. Fear has been created by my mind over the years because I run my life on self-will and I'm not successful. So then I become fearful. So that's one thing. I'll leave that. Sex. Let's talk about sex. Why do you, don't you think it's funny he got it right on 69? I think that's so hysterical. All right. So there's a couple of times when there's four times when we drink again. And Mark Houston was really big at talking about this. So the four times that we drink again are if we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life, if we fail to rid ourselves of selfishness and self-centeredness, if we shut out the sunlight of the spirit with resentment, and if we knowingly continue to harm others with our sex life. Isn't that interesting? If I fail to expand and enlarge my spiritual life, even in terms of my sex or my sexuality, that could work there. If I'm only coming for sexual expression in a selfish or self-centered manner, and if somehow I'm using sex to shut out the sunlight of the spirit, if there's somehow resentment attached with sexual behavior and identity. So it's so cool to see those four parts, and sex can be in it. Again, if you like a pig mask and a tutu, you like whatever you like, that is not what we're talking about here. Definitely not the arbiter of anyone's sex life. But what he's asking, I love when Bill says, "Hey, we all have sex problems." Wasn't that beautiful? You know, it just right there from that line, I could feel something relax. I could feel my heart opening. And he said, we'd hardly be human if we didn't. He says, what do we do about them? And I love that that's always the question. He never asks us why. He asks us, what do we do about a thing like that? Particularly when we see its impact, when we see its load, when we see its potential to drive us back to drinking. Right? He said, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? I remember I was sitting in a meeting one time and a woman was talking about the sex inventory, and she gave the instructions that she felt as though that she had hurt people with one night stands. And I thought to myself, oh, my dear woman, what does that mean? And she had all of her people write down, these people who she slept with in one night stands. And I thought, like man with cufflinks. I could remember one guy from a party, a nightclub here in LA. And in my heart, that isn't really what sex inventory is for me. What two human beings do who are equally matched and coming to for the same motivation, there is no harm. Having sexual desire, that is not the harm. The harm is, am I trying to get, forgive me, no pun intended, am I trying to get on top of someone to feel better about myself? Am I diminishing someone? Am I causing them to feel unsafe? Am I manipulative? Don Pritz, when he talked about doing sexual inventory, he was on death row, and there was no sex involved. So we were given the instructions that we write sex inventory when we make that list of people who we had harmed. Sex may sometimes not be involved in the act, but think about possession, think about controlling. Think about dominating. Think about really disturbing someone's peace in a way that's really covetous. So we must be, it says, did we justifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Jealousy, he says, is the single most deadly human emotion, right? But to look at those moments when I aroused suspicion, oh, that's a good one. It's so subtle, making people uncomfortable, using my sexuality as leverage, as confusion, as distortion, so that I could get something else, or so that I could feel like I had the upper hand. Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? The directions I got is that when you write the sex inventory, when you get to what should I have done instead, you never get to say, shouldn't have been there, shouldn't have been involved. We have to zero down. What should I have done instead? Believe it or not, the visualization of what I should have done instead, I should have called out the behavior, made an amends. I should have understood that this person was my boyfriend's son or brother or whatever, that the connections were too close. It was going to be messy to begin with. Could I understand what I should have done differently is respect the workplace, respect the fragility of the emotional state of this person being newly divorced. When I articulate what I should have done different, I'm already manifesting the imprint of doing something differently the next time. It's so beautiful. It's part of the visualization. I think I have 4 more minutes here. We get it all down on paper and we look at it. I also think sex is so important to look at. When we, I don't know if you've ever been asked to take the time to meditate or go for a walk and really consider the role that alcohol plays in our sexual identity, behavior, and sexuality. I've had so many people, myself included, when we first, thank you, when we first get sober, that there's a rattling, there's a huge disturbance, there's a kind of anxiety and paranoia that I'll never be able to, I'd like to use a curse word here. I'll never be able to get my groove on. I'll never be able to role play and feel sexy. How can I do all those things without getting high or being drunk? And I love to really ask people, walk with that. Take a hot bath. Go do some yoga. Go for a hike. Go for a workout. Go for a walk on the beach. Think about that. Think about the ways that alcohol was the puppeteer in our sex life. It's really quite incredible. Because am I showing up? But it's also the first place where I can ask God to come into my sex life. I can ask this newfound spirit of liberation and depth and expansion and power and peace and service and effectiveness, kindliness, patience, love, and tolerance. I can just begin to invite it in right here, right? I love this. Here's a great question. We write it all down, and we look at, we just ask these questions that actually is the fear inventory. And once we write it down, and again, I remember when I did my sex inventory, my brother came up and a good girlfriend of mine came up. There was no sex involved, but there was economies and energies and manipulations and expectations and possessiveness in those relationships that very much were on a kind of unconscious, sexualized kind of thing. And so it really is great to look at those hidden drives, those instincts gone awry. Oh, what does he say? Restraint of tongue and pen, restraint of thumb and send. But there's also this restraint looking at reactivity when I have these strong, oh, I don't like him. I don't like her. I don't like, there really is something about that that's about desire, right? Or fear. And so sexuality and sex can really be interesting. I'll stop. Let me dive in. It says, I love this. After we write this inventory and we see what we should have done differently, and we really get a sense of that we actually didn't come to that union equally reciprocally, really about, sharing our bodies and pleasure or experiencing something together. We then ask for a sane sex idea. What is my sex idea going to be moving forward? How is the way that I'm going to invite God into my sex life? And that can be masturbation, that can be whatever we're into. Porn and all the other things, I'm not going to get into that. But what you have to ask yourself is, does it take me closer to a drink, or does it help me somehow love the effects produced by God? Right? In our book, it says we love the effects produced by alcohol. Can I begin to look at, do I love the effects produced by God in my life? Right? And in this sexual conduct, that's what I have to start looking for. Right? And so we want to come up with a shape, a sex, a sane sex idea, a sound idea for our future sex life. We subjected each relationship to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideas and to help us live up to them. We remember always that our sex powers are God-given. When we ask God about our sex ideas and how to live up to them, this is where we may have to get a little bit of help or read a little something, talk to somebody who's willing, because religion can kind of oppress us or colonize us or be an overlay about sex. I know women and women's bodies have been defiled and absolutely destroyed through a lens of religious, I'll just say religious lens. And this is when spirituality and a kind of naturalness really need to come forth. And if we don't have that, thank you. If we don't have that, it really is here that I may have to lean back, go back to step two, and say, what is my conception of God? Do I have a punishing God? Am I hiding myself and my sexual life from God? Do I feel like God won't help me here, that God is not endorsing of sex and sexuality? It's so important. And I know for some of us, that can even be blasphemous in and of itself. But remember, as an alcoholic, I made a commitment that I would go to any lengths to be free from, alcohol. And in doing so, I have to look in some of these places that have been taboo, or that I think are already done, or that this is what my people think, so that's it. We're here to revolutionize our thinking. If alcoholism centers in my mind, it is in my mind where I have to look at what the attachments are that make alcohol necessary still. I need the buffer. Okay, so we go on. We remember always that our sex powers were God-given. I love that, and therefore good. I hope it is good for you. Neither to be used lightly or selfishly. And I love this, nor despised or loathed. Feel into that. Do I have anything in the body that's despising or loathing myself or sex? Something to ask the sunlight of the spirit. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We write it out what we'd like our sex ideal to be. We must be willing to make amends if we have done harm, provided that we do not bring still more harm in doing so. And I love this. Here he goes. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answers can come. So no one should judge our sex life. Only God can be the final judge. But you can feel it in the body, right? When it's just that kind of, oh, Ooh, you have that tinge instead of like, oh yeah, ooh, that was nice, right? Or God, God bless that person in the day they were born, whatever, right? Our sex lives should can actually bring us into greater connection and oneness with the universe and others, not just our partner. It always depends on what our motives are. And I just want to give you this because I think this is a prayer we can actually, there's a prayer on 70 that I've actually turned in, not to just about sex, but about everything, right? Suppose we fall short of the chosen idea and we stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? I love this. Some people tell us so. He says, but this is only a half truth. It depends on our motives if we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things. We believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned a great lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts about us. So check it out. Here's the prayer. We earnestly pray for the right idea. Think about something with money. Think about how you talk to somebody. Think about, that colleague at work. Think about, how you're driving. We pray for the right idea, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. I love that, the strength to do the right thing, right? And I love it if these things are really troublesome. Really, this thing about service, doing stuff and something for other people in the program, out of the program, everywhere you are. Sex is an energy. Desire is an energy. Desire can creep in ways and manifest itself in ways so subtly that I don't even know it's that. And sometimes it can come in the total opposite way. I can't stand this person. I have a revulsion. We are complex individuals. And sex is complex. I actually think it's good when it's simple, but it can be complex, right? And what I bring to it in my mind, is it selfish? Am I trying to get over? Am I going out for power? Am I trying to do harm? Is there a deliciousness in the debasement of someone else so that I can then come up? Or am I using my sexual energy to shade, confuse, knock someone off kilter? Yeah, I think we should have a whole meeting one time on sex and the steps and double-digit sobriety, getting older in time and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll shut up with this. I have a minute. I hope each of you know wherever you are in the steps, I'm saying this encouragingly. The God that I got sober with 39 years ago cannot and is not the God that's with me today. It has to evolve and deepen and really be a companionship. And I have had great and deep experiences of God and gratitude for God in making love to my partner, after making love to my partner, and just being with my partner that I never, ever knew was possible. And sitting in meditation, doing those 10 steps, being of service, looking at what it is that I suffer from in terms of alcoholism has been enough for me to be liberated sexually and to grow up sexually. And looking at those fears and resentment and sex all together, have you ever thought why he didn't talk to us about money or why he didn't talk to us about religion? He talked to us about sex. And I really think that that's the trifecta. So many threes in our program. Thanks for letting me share.